Morning, everyone. My name is Jay Stennett, and I'm an alcoholic. And God's doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because it's 10:30 on a Sunday morning, and I haven't had anything to drink yet, which for an alcoholic of my variety is a really amazing occurrence. Because, see, I'm a morning drinker. I love to drink in the morning. I'd like to thank my friend Chuck and the committee for being so kind to my family. You know, I got to bring my fabulous wife Adele with me, and it's always great to get the wife in another area code. So thanks for the excuse. And then also my AA family. You know, to be able to be here with Bill and Will and Phil. We're all ill. Anyway. And to have the opportunity to reflect and write and pray and meditate over the thing that I think is the most wonderful topic there is, which is sponsorship. Now, for those of you who are new with us, my purpose here this morning is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And it's my most fervent prayer that something I say will either excite you or offend you so much that you will go out and have a cup of coffee and have a real discussion about this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And in our book, this is the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't have a copy, I'd suggest that you get it. One of the things that was really important to me when I got sober was is that there were men and women who were referring to this literature. And I got sober on the second day of May in 1979. It was the day that I came to you, and although I found it necessary on a lot of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink, sniffed any glue, or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. But at that time, the third edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, had only been out for about 2.5 years. And there wasn't anybody talking to me about the stories being better in their big book or referring to pagination that wasn't in the book that was given to me, the third edition. So if you don't have this book, get it. Is there anybody here who is fortunate enough to sleep with another person in 12-step program? Yeah. If you want to have some real fun, take the new stories in here and try reading them aloud to each other at night. It's a nice way to build an AA home. There is a solution. It says here, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's my purpose this morning. And the way that I got that relationship with the power greater than myself was through sponsorship. And have you ever had this happen to you? They look at you and they say, "No drinking at work." Okay. Now I don't know about you, but I hate to pay retail. And so I like to tend bar, preferably during the day so I'm available for the evening's activities. And so when they say that to me, I won't have anything to drink. And this particular story happened. Anybody know the J&M in Pioneer Square?
Yeah.
I was one of the four people that helped start Fat Tuesday. If I helped any of you get here quicker, I'd like to say you're welcome. Anyway, I was working at the Germ, and they said, "No drinking at work, and don't have anything to drink before you come to work." So I got off work, and, you know, 6 o'clock, and go have a few pops with the guys, and you get home early. Everybody in this room knows what getting home early is, right? If I'm through the door at 1:30 a.m., I'm home early. If I'm through the door before last call, It's early. And so I go and I lay my head down and sleep for a little while and wake up about 3:30 in the morning because the depressant alcohol is washed through my body enough that I pop up. But fortunately, in those days, I had good sponsorship. Somebody told me, you always, you know, if you've actually got a bed, it's good to keep a cold one next to it so that when you pop up, you can just crack the beer, drink it down, settle down enough so you can get another 2 or 3 hours of rest in the body. No problem. And then I wake up about 5:30, and I start to get ready to get to work at 10. Now, the way that you do that is, right, you have a couple of beers, because as you guys all know, beer is not drinking, right? It's a food. Right? You know, the people who tell you that drinking beer is drinking, they're the same people who will try to tell you that smoking marijuana is doing drugs. It's what you do in between doing drugs, right? So anyway, I get myself prepared for work. And I got to get on the bus, right? And you guys all know why I'm a big fan of public transportation in those days. Because I can't afford to drive. Because all the driving under the influence as I've gotten, the high insurance. And so I got to go downtown because the only kind of bar that's going to hire me is downtown. And I go sliding down into Pioneer Square. And then I stop and I have another couple of beers on the way in. And they look at, I come into work and my tongue is just a little thick. And they look at you and they go, what the hell is wrong with you? Didn't we just talk about this yesterday? Yesterday, you said that you weren't going to have anything to drink before you came to work. And I look them dead in the eye and I say, I haven't been drinking. Because I hadn't. I just had a few beers. My alcoholic life is the only one that I knew. I lived in complete and total fantasy, and I had no idea that that's what the reality of my life was. I didn't know that I'm an alcoholic, and the best description I've ever heard is the Chinese proverb. The man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. One's too many, and a thousand's not enough. I was born in El Segundo, California, which, if you need a reason to drink, is as good as any. It's kind of like a Baja Tacoma. On one side of the town is the Los Angeles International Airport. On the other side is the Northrop Defense Contractor. On the other side is the Chevron Oil Refinery, whence the town got its name. And then on the little patch of beach in between the town of El Segundo and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. So toxicity is just a way of life. You want to get right with your environment. And I was born into this household to a father that looked good and moved fast and a mother who needed a drink really badly and never took it. So it got really quick around there, you know. And, you know, alcoholism doesn't run in my family. It gallops, you know. And I had no idea. I had no idea. So that's how I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to spend this time talking about sponsorship. If you're in this room, you know that if I'm lame enough to be dressed up like this at this hour of the morning on a Sunday, that I probably had a few drinks. And I'll tell you one more little thing. If you're wondering whether you're alcoholic or not, whether you have this physical allergy, this obsession of the mind, and this spiritual malady, take what it is that you do for recreation and then match it what happens with 90% of the population, the non-alcoholics. Example. By the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time is to take a rack of Reds, 3 high-powered sedative hypnotics, Secanol, and to wash it down with a quart of Spinata wine. Okay? In 90% of the population, the part that is not alcoholic, these people that don't have this physical allergy that I have, when they do that, what happens is called synergistic effect. The sedative hypnotic mixed with the alcohol starts to get the brain so loaded that many times people forget how to breathe and they throw up and then they choke on their vomit. Jimi Hendrix died that way, a bunch of different, they call it Hollywood death. Okay? With me, when I do that, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. If you ever woke up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar before you left the house that morning, you might want to try Alcoholics Anonymous. So on the second day of May, I was living in my Pinto. I wasn't homeless. It was just my outdoorsman phase. And I'd reached the point where I drank away my soul. You know how you like an alcoholic's like a cat. If it gets sick, just kind of goes away and hides. And I was just driving from place to place and stealing gasoline and drinking. And I got arrested one more time, and my father was kind enough to bail me out. And I was, and we were sitting in a Marriott in Santa Clara, California, having a couple of vodka rocks. And he said to me, "Do you think you have the disease?" And the still small voice inside of me said, "Pay really close attention. He might pay for the lawyer." And so I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, you can go down to my mother's house." She lived in El Segundo. And you can stay there. And I want you to call this friend of mine. So I didn't have any other plans. So he gave me some money. He said, "Don't have anything to drink." So I bought a couple tall six-packs of Coors for the drive. And it took me about 4 years sober to be able to use both hands when I drove. Because I always had to have something, you know. But anyway, I went down to my grandmother's house, and I gave this guy a call. And he said, "Meet me at the Howard Johnson's in Culver City, 7:30 in the morning. Don't have anything to drink." How did he know? So I went and I talked to this guy. Actually, I sat at the table, and he started talking about himself and talking about himself and talking about himself. And after about, he had some problems in his life. He met Alcoholics Anonymous, and things got all better, and he's talking about himself and talking about himself. And I need a drink really badly, and I can barely light a cigarette. And so I figure, well, I'll prompt him. I say, "Do I need psychiatric treatment? How about religion? Do I require hospitalization?" And he looked at me, and he said, "Well, Trick." He said, a hospital program will cost about $3,000. If you can get your hands on $3,000, go out and drink that money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd had a lot of helpers in my life trying to, move me in the proper direction. But I'd never run across anybody that said out loud, "What you do if you can get your hands on $3,000. Of course you go out and drink it up and then you plan your next move, right?" And he said, "You'll find it in the white pages of the phone book. Call them up. See you later." And I went back to my grandmother's. I was so profoundly affected by this conversation that I poured myself a water glass full of Davies County old-fashioned Kentucky bourbon with 3 ice cubes. And as I was drinking it down, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And this woman answered the phone. She said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, may we help you?" She said, "Don't go anywhere. I'll have somebody call you in 20 minutes. The guy called me. He said, "Hi, my name's Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. Are you willing to go to any lengths to stop drinking?" Well, I'd finished most of my drink. So I was in a fairly agreeable mood. And he said, "Do you have a car?" I said, "Yeah." I didn't tell him I'd been living in it. And he told me where the Alano Club was, and I went down to the Alano Club. And I walked in the door, and the woman behind the bar, Eunice, said, "You, upstairs." And I walked up these 12 steps into this room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody started talking at me. I couldn't figure out why they were talking at me. But when my hair's long, I kind of look like the Sphinx. And I hadn't had quite enough to drink, so I'm starting to get the zups-ups. And this guy, Butcher Joe, was the third guy who shared. They're all talking at me. And you can always tell Butcher Joe, right? And Joe looked right at me, and he talked about when the family left, how he cried the big crocodile tears. And inside he's going, "Yes! Now we can drink and nobody will mess with us." And I understood that. And he knew just how much to cut himself at work so that he could get away, go get a stitch or two, and that he could drink. And he told me that I never had to feel the way that I felt about myself at that moment ever again if I was willing to do the things that he'd done. And I was willing. I was willing. I drank away my soul. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, the lamest place in the world. And I figured, I got a moment of grace, and I figured that I'd just do this thing. Now, on my third day, I almost drank. And I went back to the Alano Club, and Larry was working the hinge, and he got me a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been too cool to get it the first couple of days. I was busy. Didn't want to look like an obvious rookie. Lacking along with my little book, you know. "Are you going to book study down at the beach?" He got me the book, and I went home, and I wasn't sleeping in those days. And they told me at that first meeting that this was the last time that I ever had to withdraw from alcohol. I couldn't believe it. But yet it was so ridiculous. I said, "What the heck?" And so I'm walking and sweating and smoking and reading this book. And I was reading through the doctor's opinion where Silkwork talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. I understood that. And I kept reading, and, you know, I mean, I was really fascinated with the stock market crash and the First World War. I mean, give me something contemporary. Give me something disco. Can you imagine how awful it was getting sober wearing those clothes? That gear's enough to make anybody drink. There were meetings, in fact, Clara may have even been secretary, where you needed 3 gold chains just to get in the door, right? Oh, man. That was a funny time. Anyway, so I kept reading this book, you know, and how did they know? And I got to that point in We Agnostics where it tells a story about the preacher's son. And about how he got down on his knees and how he had this profound experience. And in there's a line and it says, "Who are you to say that there is no God?" In religious terms, I was convicted. Because I may not espouse that. Well, I did espouse it a lot, actually. And I certainly lived that way. And so I did what this guy did. I got down on my knees. And I said my prayer. And my prayer was, I don't know, from Jesus or Buddha, the Talmud, the Upanishads, just get me the top. And I said, "I will do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Just please help me not to drink." And I believe at that moment I'd done the first 3 steps. I said it with all the sincerity of my heart, and that's... the prayer was perfect. I'm here with you this morning, not drinking. So I went to the club the next morning. Believe it or not, God had not created morning meetings yet. So you had to wait outside the door of the Alano Club at 9 o'clock for them to open for the noon meeting. It was kind of a zombie walk, and I went up into the room to wait for the meeting, and there was this woman sitting there, and she had on a black dress and her hair in a bun and correct shoes on, and she, you know, "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you? How can you tell?" She said, "I can tell you the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. What are they? Find God or die." "No! Not that! No!" And 26 years later, I can tell you the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. Find God or die. But the great thing is that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we will never suppose to tell you what kind of God it is that you have to find. But you have to find one. You can use the group. Works really, really well. Worked really well for me in the beginning. You can use your sponsors. Or you can use your friends. But at some point, you're going to have to find your own. And how do you do that? How do you do that? Well, what we have is we have a set of spiritual exercises, which when done, actually produce a relationship with a power that will solve your problem. Now, if you only agree with it, I'm not sure about that. You'd not drink, but you don't get this regeneration that happened with me. And how is this transferred? How is this knowledge transferred? One person to another. So I'm sitting in this meeting. When I came to AA, my entire wardrobe was, I had a good t-shirt, a bad t-shirt, a pair of Levi's, and some bowling shoes. I'm the reason you have to give them in order to get them. You know, I said, "Size 8.5, please." And I boogied with the shoes. And so I'm stuck to the knot. Why is it they have Naga hide in the Alano Club? You know, you're just stuck to it. And this guy got up and he took a birthday cake for 4 years. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. And I will never, ever be able to repay the kindness of that man and his Al-Anon wife and what it is that they did for me. Because I was a real alcoholic and I was baffled about how to get through a day without drinking. I was obsessed with drinking. Every third thought was about, I got to get a drink. No, we're not drinking right now. Oh, no, okay. And I just show up on the porch. And he'd still be at work, and Bonnie'd let me in and make some coffee and talk to me while I smoked cigarettes. And, you know, and that kindness. When I was 22 days and I was reading in the big book, and it said that, you know, if you don't do your inventory, you're going to drink. I ran to my sponsor. I said, "I got to do my inventory. I don't want to drink." I said, "Fine." And he and a buddy of his who had a long time sat there and told me silly stories about, you know, mammals and non-mammals and things that they'd stolen and things that they'd wanted to steal and things that they were afraid of. And my sponsor said, "Okay, here's the four-step prayer. What you do is go get really jacked up on coffee." He said, "Sit down at the kitchen table and look at the door." He said, "Here's the prayer. Write it down. God, I don't know what I'm doing. Help me, please." And then he said, "I want you to think of every place that you lived and every job that you had and every group that you ran with. And if, as people from these different phases of your life walk through the door, if your stomach goes like that, write their name down, and then you get three sentences on why. Nobody's life is that interesting." And I did that. And then he said, write the sexual weirdness. He said, who you hate and who you're afraid of. And he said, and then we'll talk tomorrow. Took me about 4 hours. It was fairly long. It was maybe 5 pages legal. And I write big because I shake a lot. And I got it done. Was it a fearless thorough moral inventory using all four columns. No! No. It was the greatest hits. You know? It was the stuff that when my head goes down on the pillow, it always popped up. And I got it out of my head and onto the paper, and my sponsor came and we sat down. We read the stuff, and I said the stupid prayers, and then we burned it. And I'm 23 days sober, and I'm a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done some stuff. I'm not just sitting in a chair agreeing with it. Now, this is the program of recovery that in those days was what we were doing. Wasn't a lot of books. There wasn't a lot of book studying going on because the telephone was ringing at the Alano Club, you know, and I had a car. And they'd say, don't talk to him. Go pick him up and bring him back. We'll take care of it from there. You know, and I got out and I started making my amends. And I went to my grandmother Alice, who used to have the Oxbow Inn down on... down on East Marginal there next to Boeing Field, and she taught me how to tend bar. I owed her just a little money. And I said, Grandmother, I've stolen this money from you, and I'm God and AA are keeping me sober. Please forgive me. Here's some of the money. And she said, what'd you say? I said, God and AA are keeping me sober. Here's some money. And she goes, thanks. And then she got her purse and her hat, and she starts moving for the door. Where are you going? She said, about 5 years ago, you and I had a conversation where you said you didn't believe in God anymore. So I went down and I put your name on a list down at the church, and me and the girls have been praying for you, and I get to go down and report that my grandson has been restored. Spiritual terrorism. It works really, really well. In 1985, my then wife Jacqueline got sober, and it was a wonderful occurrence in my life. And we picked three people: her best childhood friend, our friend Jeannie, who was working at a cocktail waitress at a saloon that we were working in, and then my sister Regina, who was missing in action with her self-employed Colombian boyfriend. And we prayed for him at every meeting we went to, in the moment of meditation afterwards. Within a year and a half, all three of them got sober. All three of them picked up birthday cakes. And after that, one of them, the girl who got sober in the treatment center, decided that she'd made a mistake. She'd made too much of this. But Jeannie and my sister Regina have not had a drink since. Alcoholics Anonymous, it works. It really, really works. I'll give you spiritual terrorism 101. Because you all know somebody who's really bad. Like, you may be in here just getting the heat off, being good for a little while, but you know somebody's got a real problem. You know? The one you're always looking down at, if I ever get that bad. And then a year later, he's worse, so you got a ways to go still. When you walk into a meeting place and you see an empty chair, just walk up and tap the chair and say their name. I believe that that person may be sent to the meeting. That may be somebody that I work with that saves my life. So, Michael and I, in those days, we were just running around, grabbing drunks, going to coffee. It was a whole different society. The downsizing hadn't happened. The treatment centers hadn't funneled a lot of people in. We were busy. Phone was ringing off the hook. That's the way we became members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Clara described it so well yesterday, that it was in the seeing ourselves and the suffering of another that we really got a clue of who we were. And then when this treatment center started sending lots of people in, what happened is that the activity got different. And we had lots of people who were coming into Alcoholics Anonymous with information that they'd gotten from well-meaning professional people. And one of the great things that happened is that Alcoholics Anonymous stayed Alcoholics Anonymous, because there were some really, really well-meaning, well-intentioned, brilliant people that wanted us to be all things to all people. And what happened is that those of us who were here, we went back to the literature. And we got in this process of working with people, reading out of the book. Now, most folks, in those days, that was not going on. It was not part of the culture in Los Angeles that I know of. And most of the people that were sober in those days, they were not reading the book one-on-one with people. And I didn't know about that. I didn't know. How did I start doing that? The way I started doing that was I had this sponsor by the name of Fred. Mike had left town, and I had this sponsor, Fred Ellis. And Fred was one of the great members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a tremendous man. In fact, what I did was that I just I thought about it for a while, and I just went and I asked the man that I admired most in Alcoholics Anonymous to be my sponsor. And he was a busy guy. And he said, you may not be able to get me whenever you want me. But he said, if you ever need me, you will always be able to get me. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I'm going along working with Fred, and it's all about, guys like you don't sign up on any speaker lists, because he knew who I was. See, I didn't get to do this kind of thing until I didn't have anything to say. And anyway, one day I was in those days, this is the mid 80s, and my then wife had gotten sober, and so I'm back to going to 7 meetings a week, and I'm, secretary of the speaker meeting. The people that are the best sponsors in the world are the ones between 3 and 8 years sober, because they know everything and they're willing to tell you for hours on end. Get a sponsor who still smokes. They really know the truth. Anyway, I had a job, a traveling sales job, and I'm busy. During that time, there were a few guys that came to me and asked me to sponsor them, and there was this one guy that came up, and he was shuffling like this, and his glasses hadn't been cleaned in about 7 weeks. And he'd just gotten out of the Twin Towers, the county jail down in Los Angeles, and he was just really unsettled on his pins, and he asked me to be his sponsor, and I took one look at him, and I said, I'm really busy in AA, and why don't we get together tomorrow, and we'll go to the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag Monday night, and I'll introduce you to some guys who can save your life. I was not used to standing up for myself. I wasn't used to giving myself care. So I called to report to my sponsor about how much I'd evolved spiritually. The insights that I'd had about myself. My quest to find balance in my life. And he said, "You did what?" He said, "You go and you find that man and you ask him if you can please have the honor of sharing with him what has been so freely given to you. Did I say no to you? Click!" Fred had been a Marine. And he'd been a numbers runner for the mob in Los Angeles while suffering from blackouts. He didn't want him mad. So I went and I found Kevin. And Kevin had left school in 5th grade. And Kevin couldn't read. And so that's where I started reading aloud with guys. Because every time Kevin came over and we read together, I got a lot out of what was going on. before that, I'd had guys, you know, reading and then just, are you reading the big book? Oh, yeah, I'm reading the big book. Ready to do the third step? Oh, well, blah, blah, blah. You know. Are you working on your inventory? Yeah, I'm working on it. Now, I started formatting a little bit. And then what I did was, is because I wanted to grow in effectiveness, I started sponsoring people when I had like 29 days sober. Guy walked up to me and asked me to sponsor him. I went to my sponsor. I said, what should I do? He said, if they're sick enough to ask you, you have to say yes. Hopefully you're the lower rung on the ladder. Help him up. Okay. And but what had happened, see, I'm alcoholic. And I'm afraid that I'm not going to drink. And I'm obsessed with alcohol when I'm new. And every time my sponsor would say to me that he thought he might be someplace, I was there. I never missed an appointment with him. I never missed having Friday dinner with he and his wife, where we'd sit around and talk about sobriety, and they'd all laugh at me. She and her Al-Anon friends. And Bonnie Bergman, who died of cancer a long time ago. And so I took out great men, Jack Prose, Ken O'Brien, Fred Ellis, Vern Stamps. And I asked each of these men what their sponsors did with them. And I took a pad and a piece of paper and I said, and then what do you do with the guys that they sponsor? And they were, you know, I mean, when you ask people you admire what they do, they love to talk about themselves. Especially if you're buying lunch. Buy people you admire lunch. If you're secretary of a speaker meeting, you want to make AA a wonderful place to be, ask the speakers if they'd like to come and join you for dinner before the meeting. You know, because they all need to get a bite to eat. But what happens is that's how I got close to Clara. You know, it was, you know, I mean, that's what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know all these wonderful people just because somebody said, hey, I didn't know how to answer the telephone until I was 35 years old. I'm sober 11 years and I call Dr. Paul up and I say, hey, I call Paul up and he picks the phone up and he says, hi, this is Paul. How may I help you? Any conversation that I get to have with a person, I try and remember always to say, is there something I can do for you? It's amazing what people will tell you. Just paying attention in AA. So I got this stuff and I started working. I mixed some stuff around and I came up with a format that kind of worked for me. You know, and it changes over time. You know, because this thing about passing the information on is a wonderful thing. But this one-on-one, working the steps with people is just a great, it's a great, great thing. Fred died of cancer in 1987. What am I going to do? I've had one of the great men. And so when he'd been diagnosed again, I came up with the sponsor. Here's the find the sponsor prayer. God, if there be a God, if you want that, you can put that part in. Help me to recognize the person when they come through the door. And I was sitting at a meeting, and there was this guy who got up, and he started spouting this hard-line, big book stuff. And I thought, Fred wasn't dead yet. And I thought, oh, I should talk to that guy. And then, of course, I forgot about it. But a few months after Fred passed, I kept saying that prayer, and this man was at the meeting, and I went, oh. And then I went and asked him to lunch, and I sat down to kind of interview him a little bit and found out that every area of my life, there was something that he had experience in. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing to have an AA home. The most important job in the world aside, of course, from the GSR. The most important job in Alcoholics Anonymous is actually the sponsor's wife. She's a counterintelligence agent and a great source of information. When I was courting my wife, I said to her, I need your help. When I was courting Adele, I said, I need your help. Will you help my friends who have no skills at all? Will you help them to get into nice, wonderful, loving relationships? And she said, yes. And our home is a source of nurturing for men and women that are on the path, learning to share, wanting to share their lives with another human being. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Newcomers come first in our house. It doesn't matter when the phone rings. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. It's just God on the phone anyway. That's one of the things Fred told me. Well, I'm sponsoring a lot of people. He said, no, you're not. He said, never, ever count the number of people you sponsor. Don't know. He said, you're just sponsoring the next person that's on the telephone. So I got no responsibility. I just answer the phone. So this household that we have is just, it's a wonderful thing. You know, there's this these disparaging remarks about, oh, I'm not going to date a woman in the program, or, hey, men are all a bunch of pigs. Okay. but, you know, see, if Alcoholics Anonymous is the first thing in my life, how the, if I'm out shopping for a mate, why am I not going to get somebody that is on this path? They don't have to be in AA, but Al-Anon or OA. I had a guy, an old timer, one time tell me, look me dead in the eye and say, women who are in the program, in recovery, in the program of Overeaters Anonymous are the greatest lovers in the world. Because they have to work the program harder than anyone because they walk the tiger every day. And I got one. I got mine. But, you know, I mean, what is it, the line, the dating in Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. But can you imagine a guy like me trying to represent that I don't have any problems to anyone? I mean, if a woman finds me attractive, there are large psychic gaps, okay? And I'd much rather have her at least acknowledge that she has them. The holiest place in the world is the birthing room, to be there when a child is born. The second holiest place in the world is the coffee table, where a woman or a man says, I think this might work for me. This is the greatest privilege that anyone can have. You can actually be there at the moment that somebody's soul is reignited, or their spirit is reborn, or however you want to say it. You know, I mean, but something happens, and you have the privilege to be there. And once you've tasted it, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And as you go along, you get to go through all the different processes of, you know, people say, oh, I don't sponsor there. I'm just not good at it. They'll drink. Read the book. You know, Bill worked for a long, long time before he started to get people even starting to be interested. And that was Cleveland. You know, and of all the people that ask me to work with them, I mean, how many actually keep showing up? You know, you have to be pretty badly mangled to end up in my living room. It's always fascinating who's on my couch. you know. And so we go through this process. Fun thing happened a number of years ago. I was about, I was 14 and a half years sober. I was in a big change in my life. My first marriage had ended. I was with my fabulous wife, Adele. A guy was busy smoking crack and was trying to get a guy that I sponsored was on the 12-step call away from him. He was in the bathroom, and so he threw this pamphlet that had been written in Texas, and that Dr. Paul had put in a format about an unofficial guide to the 12 steps about working at a group. And so I called all the guys up, and I said, I'm coming up on 15 years sober, and I'd like you to come and join me in working the steps. So the gang showed up, and I think Bill lasted two meetings, went off and formed his own group. Because I wasn't doing it correctly. And he didn't even have the interferon card to play in those days. But anyway, we sat down in this group. We started out with about 18 of us, and it whittled down to about 14. And of the 14, 12 of us actually did all the stuff. And what happened is I saw for the first time at a group level, within a year and a half, all these men's lives changed radically. All of us had more fabulous relationships. Our business careers all changed. I mean, it was just remarkable. And once again, I was able to see the power in a way that I hadn't experienced it before. And it was an incredible thing. Bill talked a little bit about our friend Patrick Keelahan. Keelahan. Try spelling that. And his mother really did call him the devil of all liars. I have heard him referred to as the sleaziest man in Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was in the freight forwarding business. And so he was always busy on Friday. And if I sponsor you, there are two things. I want you to go to at least one of the meetings that I go to, hopefully the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. And then second, we go on retreat every year. You know, you circle these dates. This is the requirement. Everybody knows. So Pat would go, yeah, I'm going to be on the retreat. I'm going to be on the retreat. I'll be there late. And he'd go on retreat all right. He'd stop on Century Boulevard, get a couple professionals, a couple eight balls, and go to the Viscount Hotel and spend the weekend there. Guy never had a sobriety date much, and then finally, he got sober. You know, he always represented himself as being sober. In fact, one time I was, after he'd gotten sober, this time he was, I was driving along and I was out of town on business and I wasn't going to be able to give him a birthday cake, and he's ragging on me about, oh, you're not going to be there to give me my two-year cake. How can you do? What kind of sponsor? Blah, 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 blah. And I thought about it, and I'd already given him a two-year cake. He just wasn't sober at the time. I said, screw you, Trick. I did my job just because you weren't really there. But I didn't fire Patrick. They don't hire me, and I can't send anybody away. Who God sends to me, they're taking advantage of me. Oh, really? How tragic. They're eating up my valuable time. Well, get some boundaries. You know? But, you know, we don't send them away. So here's this guy. I mean, bad example, number 305A, okay? And he calls one day, and he says, I got lung cancer. I'm going to die, and I'm afraid. And from the doctor's office, he came to our house, and we sat there and we prayed, and it was time. Am I full of shit? Or aren't I? Will I show up? What kind of man am I really? And what I found out is that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member in good standing of AA, and I go where I'm asked, and I do the next good thing. There's no question. There's no question. If you're sitting around wondering, what's the next good thing to do? And then go do it. And so we walked this man, who was 39 years old, to the door. And it was not easy, and it was not fun. But along the line, you know, we had a good time. We really did. And Patrick gave us a lot of gifts, and it was so funny. Adele and I were going to go on our honeymoon. We were going to leave, go to Hawaii. And he called me up, and he said, "You can't go. I'm dying." And I looked at Adele, and I said, "We can't go. He's dying. And if we would have gone, he would have passed." So we just never made it to Hawaii until this year. It was 7-8 years ago. Because I'm called to love. See, when people ask us to sponsor them, what they're asking us to do is to love them. Maybe for the first time in their life. And what we get to do is we get to learn to love. And the longer we love and the better we get at loving, what happens is that there's fewer and fewer demands that we make about loving. And we grow in effectiveness. And we enter into this fourth dimension of existence that is beyond description. It is thrilling to live in the fourth dimension. And it does exist. It's not something that's just written in this silly book. If you don't just agree with AA, but if you buy the whole package and you come on this ride, buckle up, baby. It'll never look anything like you think it will. But where you end up is insanely wonderful. You know, it's just amazing. And just doing the next good thing. I had the privilege of reciting St. Patrick's breastplate with the immigrant mother anointing her son moments before he passed. I used to live in a Pinto. And you see me today walking down the street, and I'm picking up cigarette butts. And I won't look you in the eye. That's who I am. And people now call me when their babies are being born. And they call me when their babies are dying. And that seemingly good and that seemingly bad, I can't do anything about that. But I can make the experience sober. I can help people not to drink through it. You keep sponsoring people, and I pray what happened to me happens to you. That everything you know about God gets stripped from you. And you stand there after going to the hospital day in and day out and watching people suffering. And, you know, you think about what you'd heard about Jesus. You know, he did what he wanted to. He was 36 years old. They had a bad weekend, you know. And you see these people suffering for months. And I went through this period of about 6 weeks where I had no connection with God. I always had something going on. And then one night, I walk out of the Miller's Children's Hospital and I smelled the night blooming jasmine. I came back because I was willing. I was wanting. I was waiting. And it came. So I won't presume to tell you any more about God. So I'm going to tell you how God smells. And sometimes she smells really sweet. You know, there's... I had an experience when I was newly sober where I saw the light. And I know that everything's perfect. I forget frequently. You know, I want to get a tattoo and put it on my wife's forehead. Perfect. Because I forget sometimes. Dream deep. Dream deep. Start living. If you're sober and you're involved in this work, drop all your fears and just get out there on the edge. and you'll have experiences that are beyond your wildest dreams. You know, I was sitting around before the beginning of this year going, if I could do anything, what would I do? And Frank Buchman, the guy who started the Oxford Group, said, if you get a chance to ever talk to a person, tell them your deepest truth. And this is my deepest truth, that I had a wonderful, wonderful life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had all the love. I had everything that a man could ever want. But when I started adding meditation to my life, my relationship with this world changed. And it became a whole lot better, especially for those around me. So I want to suggest to you that the 11th step is not a Chinese menu. From my experience, you can tell that I'm really good praying, right? I can talk all day long to God. I'm good at it. But until I started sitting in the silence, my life changed. So I'm sitting around, and I go, if I could do anything, what would I do? And Frank Buchman, the guy who started the Oxford Group, at one point they changed it to moral rearmament to try and get nations to change instead of people, to try and stop the Second World War. And on the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of December in 1939, they tried to get 100 million people to sit in the quiet to listen if there might be a solution other than violence. It's the most outlandish thing I've ever heard. And this has got nothing to do with your political persuasion or where you are. But I am talking about that there is an answer beyond our human consciousness. And so I thought if I could do anything in the world, I'd invite people to get quiet. So I went to a buddy of mine and I started this thing called 3 minutes of silence. I got a card up here if you want it. And it's the number 3, then minutesofsilence.org. Encouraging people to spend 3 minutes a day in silence. And on it, there's a wheel with a dozen different ways to get quiet, different religions, stuff that's non-religious, just spiritual. Just to encourage people to try it. You know, do spirituality the way you drank, man. Dive in. Try it all. But if they look at you, there's a caveat. If they look at you and they tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of consciousness, smile at them. And move away. Because they don't have to know. But we know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do is that we care for the sick. And we visit them in the jails. And we raise the dead. And they don't know that. And they won't understand it. And they don't need to. So the second day of October was the first time that we got people from all over the planet within this particular format to get quiet together. And I had a tremendous, tremendous experience, and some of my friends did too, and it was a wonderful thing. But what it was my dream. I did my dream, and I'm doing my dream. And part of my dream that day, there's many of you here that I know that I was able to, you know, bring through my heart that day. As I was ramping up to that 3 minutes, you know, and my life is not my own. Thursday, I'm talking to a kid from Vietnam. I said, I need a friend in Vietnam. And he told me some stuff that he's doing. And so we're going to go build some schools in the Mekong Delta. Why not? What better thing do I have to do? My father never came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was a bad drunk. And when his drinking partner, my stepmother, Marcia, died of cirrhosis, the way that they were able to express, this is my DNA, this is my family of origin, this is the way they made love at the end. They drank salty dogs and ate Vicodin together. Alcoholism, the family disease. Anyway, after she died, I waited a few weeks, and I went up, and I drove up, and I caught the old man. He was sitting in his command post. He lived 10 hours away. I just happened to drop by. And he was in his command post, covered in his own waste. And I was able to clean him up, put him in the shower, not talk down to him. You know why? Because I've been on the 12-step calls. I know how to do that. And I got him cleaned up, and I said, okay, Dad, I'm going to take you to detox tomorrow. I'm not talking about you going to the silly meetings, but we're going to go detox tomorrow. And next morning, he said, nope, been thinking all night, not going to go. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just hit him with something heavy, and we'll throw him in the trunk. No big deal. And so anyway, I take him, and I want to take him, and he won't go. So I went and had a quad espresso, and I meditated for a little while. And I remembered Dr. Bob's line about, you know, if you want to quit drinking on your own, that's entirely your affair. And I let it, you know, and so I left without any acrimony at all. I just said, okay. And he kicked by himself. And anyway, after a while, it was Easter the next year, and my sister called me, and she said, Dad's really sick. You better get up there. And so I went up, and I saw him, and I let him be a cowboy for a day. And then he was living down in Wairika, had a ranch down there. And so I take him to the hospital, and he's got cancer growing fast. And so I got to sit there with him and say, I don't like the hand. And he said, well, what do we do? And I said, well, let's go home. I got the skills. I got the time. I knew how to do it. Gordon and Priscilla Cleveland had let me in their home when they were dying. I'd walked my friend Patrick to the door. I knew how to be a man. I knew how to be a son. And we went home, you know. And a couple weeks later, he died. When he died, his mother was there, and my sister was there, my sister's been sober. My sister Regina's been sober for coming up on 20 years. And she, had a conversation one day with him, and she was talking about her sponsor. And he said, well, what's a sponsor? And she described what she thought a sponsor was. And I'd been talking to my dad about staying away from the front drink and all that stuff, and why I don't drink, you know, Virgin Marys. And my dad said, well, I guess Jay would be my sponsor. Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It's not in the first 164 pages of the book, by the way. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to do to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Number two, it is a pleasure. Number three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me. But at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink and knew I could not, but I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it because nobody ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat. If you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you think you're strong enough to beat the game on your own, that's entirely your affair. But if you wish to quit drinking liquor for good and for all, we know we have an answer for you. It works. It never fails. If you go about it with one half the zeal that you're in the habit showing when you were getting your next drink. your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Thank you. Morning, everyone. My name's Jay Stennett, and I'm an alcoholic. And God's doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because it's 10:30 on a Sunday morning, and I haven't had anything to drink yet, which for an alcoholic of my variety is a really amazing occurrence. Because, see, I'm a morning drinker. I love to drink in the morning. I'd like to thank my friend Chuck and the committee for being so kind to my family. You know, I got to bring my fabulous wife, Adele, with me, and it's always great to get the wife in another area code. So thanks for the excuse. And then also my AA family. You know, to be able to be here with Bill and Will and Phil. We're all ill. Anyway. And to have the opportunity to reflect and write and pray and meditate over the thing that I think is the most wonderful topic there is, which is sponsorship. Now, for those of you who are new with us, my purpose here this morning is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And it's my most fervent prayer that something I say will either excite you or offend you so much that you will go out and have a cup of coffee and have a real discussion about this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And in our book, this is the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't have a copy, I'd suggest that you get it. One of the things that was really important to me when I got sober was is that there were men and women who were referring to this literature. And I got sober on the second day of May in 1979. It was the day that I came to you, and although I found it necessary on a lot of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink, sniffed any glue, or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. But at that time, the third edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, had only been out for about 2.5 years. And there wasn't anybody talking to me about the stories being better in their big book or referring to pagination that wasn't in the book that was given to me, the third edition. So if you don't have this book, get it. Is there anybody here who is fortunate enough to sleep with another person in 12-step program? Yeah. If you want to have some real fun, take the new stories in here and try reading them aloud to each other at night. It's a nice way to build an AA home. There is a solution. It says here, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's my purpose this morning. And the way that I got that relationship with the power greater than myself was through sponsorship. And have you ever had this happen to you? They look at you and they say, "No drinking at work." Okay. Now I don't know about you, but I hate to pay retail. And so I like to tend bar, preferably during the day so I'm available for the evening's activities. And so when they say that to me, I go, "Oh, okay, I won't have anything to drink." And this particular story happened. Anybody know the J&M in Pioneer Square?
Yeah.
I was one of the four people that helped start Fat Tuesday. If I helped any of you get here quicker, I'd like to say you're welcome. Anyway, I was working at the Germ, and they said, "No drinking at work." and don't have anything to drink before you come to work. So I got off work and, you know, 6 o'clock and go have a few pops with the guys. And you get home early. Everybody in this room knows what getting home early is, right? If I'm through the door at 1:30 a.m., I'm home early. If I'm through the door before last call, it's early. And so I go and I lay my head down and sleep for a little while and wake up about 3:30 in the morning because the depressant alcohol is washed through my body enough that I pop up. But fortunately, in those days, I had good sponsorship. Somebody told me, you always, you know, if you've actually got a bed, it's good to keep a cold one next to it so that when you pop up, you can just crack the beer, drink it down, settle down enough so you can get another 2 or 3 hours of rest in the body. No problem. And then I wake up about 5:30, and I start to get ready to get to work at 10. Now, the way that you do that is, right, you have a couple of beers, because as you guys all know, beer is not drinking, right? It's a food. Right? You know, the people who tell you that drinking beer is drinking, they're the same people who will try to tell you that smoking marijuana is doing drugs. It's what you do in between doing drugs, right? So anyway, I get myself prepared for work. And I got to get on the bus, right? And you guys all know why I'm a big fan of public transportation in those days. Because I can't afford to drive. Because all the driving under the influences I've gotten, the high insurance. And so I got to go downtown because the only kind of bar that's going to hire me is downtown. And I go sliding down into Pioneer Square. And then I stop and I have another couple of beers on the way in. And they look at, I come into work and my tongue was just a little thick. And they look at you and they go, what the hell is wrong with you? Didn't we just talk about this yesterday? Yesterday, you said that you weren't going to have anything to drink before you came to work. And I look them dead in the eye and I say, I haven't been drinking. Because I hadn't. I just had a few beers. My alcoholic life is the only one that I knew. I lived in complete and total fantasy, and I had no idea that that's what the reality of my life was. I didn't know that I'm an alcoholic, and the best description I've ever heard is the Chinese proverb. The man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. One's too many and 1,000's not enough. I was born in El Segundo, California, which, if you need a reason to drink, is as good as any. It's kind of like a Baja Tacoma. On one side of the town is the Los Angeles International Airport. On the other side is the Northrop Defense Contractor. On the other side is the Chevron Oil Refinery, whence the town got its name. And then on the little patch of beach in between the town of El Segundo and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. So toxicity is just a way of life. You want to get right with your environment. And I was born into this household to a father that looked good and moved fast and a mother who needed a drink really badly and never took it. So it got really quick around there, you know. And, you know, alcoholism doesn't run in my family. It gallops, you know. And I had no idea. I had no idea. So that's how I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to spend this time talking about sponsorship. If you're in this room, you know that if I'm lame enough to be dressed up like this at this hour of the morning on a Sunday, that I probably had a few drinks. And I'll tell you one more little thing. If you're wondering whether you're alcoholic or not, whether you have this physical allergy, this obsession of the mind, and this spiritual malady, take what it is that you do for recreation and then match it what happens with 90% of the population, the non-alcoholics. Example. By the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time is to take a rack of Reds, 3 high-powered sedative hypnotics, Seconal, and to wash it down with a quart of Spinata wine. Okay? In 90% of the population, the part that is not alcoholic, these people that don't have this physical allergy that I have, when they do that, what happens is called synergistic effect. Sedative hypnotic mixed with the alcohol starts to get the brain so loaded that many times people forget how to breathe, and they throw up, and then they choke on their vomit. Jimi Hendrix died that way, a bunch of different folks. They call it Hollywood death, okay? With me, when I do that, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. If you ever woke up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar before you left the house that morning, you might want to try Alcoholics Anonymous. So on the second day of May, I was living in my Pinto. I wasn't homeless. It was just my outdoorsman phase. And I'd reached the point where I drank away my soul. You know how you're like an alcoholic, it's like a cat. If it gets sick, it just kind of goes away and hides. And I was just driving from place to place and stealing gasoline and drinking. And I got arrested one more time, and my father was kind enough to bail me out. And I was, and we were sitting in a Marriott in Santa Clara, California, having a couple of vodka rocks. And he said to me, "Do you think you have the disease?" And the still small voice inside of me said, "Pay really close attention. He might pay for the lawyer." And so I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, you can go down to my mother's house." She lived in El Segundo. And you can stay there, and I want you to call this friend of mine. So I didn't have any other plans, so he gave me some money, said, "Don't have anything to drink," so I bought a couple tall six-packs of Coors for the drive. And, it took me about 4 years sober to be able to use both hands when I drove, because I always had to have something, you know. But anyway, I went down to my grandmother's house, and I gave this guy a call, and he said, "Meet me at the Howard Johnson's in Culver City, 7:30 in the morning. Don't have anything to drink." How did he know? So I went and I talked to this guy. Actually, I sat at the table and he started talking about himself and talking about himself and talking about himself. And after about, he had some problems in his life. He met Alcoholics Anonymous and things got all better. And he's talking about himself and talking about himself. And I need a drink really badly and I can barely light a cigarette. And so I figure, well, I'll prompt him. I say, "Do I need psychiatric treatment? How about religion? Do I require hospitalization?" And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Trick." He said, "A hospital program will cost about $3,000. If you can get your hands on $3,000, go out and drink that money up, and when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free." Now, I don't know about you, but I'd had a lot of helpers in my life trying to, move me in the proper direction, but I'd never run across anybody that said out loud, "What you do if you can get your hands on $3,000. Of course you go out and drink it up and then you plan your next move, right?" And he said, "You'll find it in the white pages of the phone book. Call them up. See you later." And I went back to my grandmother's. I was so profoundly affected by this conversation that I poured myself a water glass full of Davies County old-fashioned Kentucky bourbon with 3 ice cubes. And as I was drinking it down, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And this woman answered the phone. She said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, may we help you?" She said, "Don't go anywhere. I'll have somebody call you in 20 minutes. The guy called me. He said, "Hi, my name's Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. Are you willing to go to any lengths to stop drinking? Well, I'd finished most of my drink. So I was in a fairly agreeable mood. And he said, do you have a car? I said, yeah. I didn't tell him I'd been living in it, but he told me where the Ilano Club was, and I went down to the Ilano Club. And I walked in the door, and the woman behind the bar, Eunice, said, you, upstairs. And I walked up these 12 steps into this room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody started talking at me. I couldn't figure out why they were talking at me. But when my hair's long, I kind of look like the Sphinx. And I hadn't had quite enough to drink, so I'm starting to get the zups-ups. And this guy, Butcher Joe, was the third guy who shared. They're all talking at me. And you can always tell Butcher Joe, right? And Joe looked right at me, and he talked about when the family left, how he cried the big crocodile tears. And inside he's going, yes! Now we can drink and nobody will mess with us. And I understood that. And he knew just how much to cut himself at work so that he could get away, go get a stitch or two, and that he could drink. And he told me that I never had to feel the way that I felt about myself at that moment ever again if I was willing to do the things that he'd done. And I was willing. I was willing. I drank away my soul. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, the lamest place in the world. And I figured, I got a moment of grace, and I figured that I'd just do this thing. Now, on my third day, I almost drank. And I went back to the Ilano Club, and Larry was working the hinge, and he got me a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been too cool to get it the first couple of days. I was busy. Didn't want to look like an obvious rookie. Lacking off my little book, you know. Are you going to book study down at the beach? He got me the book, and I went home, and I wasn't sleeping in those days. And they told me at that first meeting that this was the last time that I ever had to withdraw from alcohol. I couldn't believe it. But yet it was so ridiculous, I said, what the heck? And so I'm walking and sweating and smoking and reading this book, and I was reading through the doctor's opinion where Silkwork talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. I understood that. And I kept reading, and, you know, I mean, I was really fascinated with the stock market crash and the First World War. I mean, give me something contemporary. Give me something disco. Can you imagine how awful it was getting sober wearing those clothes? That gear's enough to make anybody drink. There were meetings, in fact, Clara may have even been secretary, where you needed 3 gold chains just to get in the door, right? Oh, man. That was a funny time. Anyway, so I kept reading this book, you know, and how did they know? And I got to that point in We Agnostics where it tells a story about the preacher's son and about how he got down on his knees and how he had this profound experience. And in there's a line, and it says, who are you to say that there is no God? In religious terms, I was convicted. Because I may not espouse that. Well, I did espouse it a lot, actually. And I certainly lived that way. And so I did what this guy did. I got down on my knees, and I said my prayer. And my prayer was, I don't know, from Jesus or Buddha, the Talmud, the Upanishads, just get me the top. And I said, I will do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Just please help me not to drink. And I believe at that moment I'd done the first 3 steps. I said it with all the sincerity in my heart, and that's the prayer was perfect. I'm here with you this morning, not drinking. So I went to the club the next morning. Believe it or not, God had not created morning meetings yet. So you had to wait outside the door of the Alano Club at 9 o'clock for them to open for the noon meeting. It was kind of a zombie walk. And I went up into the room to wait for the meeting, and there was this woman sitting there, and she had on a black dress and her hair in a bun and cracked shoes on. And she, you know, "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you? How can you tell?" She said, "I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. What are they? Find God or die." "No! Not that! No!" And 26 years later, I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. Find God or die. But the great thing is that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we will never suppose to tell you what kind of God it is that you have to find. But you have to find one. You can use the group. Works really, really well. Worked really well for me in the beginning. You can use your sponsors. Or you can use your friends. But at some point, you're going to have to find your own. And how do you do that? How do you do that? Well, what we have is we have a set of spiritual exercises, which when done, actually produce a relationship with a power that will solve your problem. Now, if you only agree with it, I'm not sure about that. You'd not drink, but you don't get this regeneration that happened with me. And how is this transferred? How is this knowledge transferred? One person to another. So I'm sitting in this meeting. When I came to AA, my entire wardrobe was, I had a good t-shirt, a bad t-shirt, a pair of Levi's, and some bowling shoes. I'm the reason you have to give them in order to get them. You know, I said, "Size 8.5, please," and I boogied with the shoes. And so I'm stuck to the knot. Why is it they have Naga hide in the Alano Club? You know, you're just stuck to it. And this guy got up and he took a birthday cake for 4 years. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. And I will never, ever be able to repay the kindness of that man and his Al-Anon wife and what it is that they did for me. Because I was a real alcoholic and I was baffled about how to get through a day without drinking. I was obsessed with drinking. Every third thought was about, "I got to get a drink." "No, we're not drinking right now." "Oh, no, okay." And I'd just show up on the porch. And he'd still be at work, and Bonnie'd let me in and make some coffee and talk to me while I smoked cigarettes. And, you know, and that kindness. When I was 22 days, when I was reading in the big book, and it said that, you know, if you don't do your inventory, you're going to drink, I ran to my sponsor. I said, "I got to do my inventory. I don't want to drink." I said, "Fine." And he and a buddy of his who had a long time sat there and told me silly stories about, you know, mammals and non-mammals and things that they'd stolen and things that they'd wanted to steal and things that they were afraid of. And my sponsor said, "Okay, here's the four-step prayer. What you do is go get really jacked up on coffee." He said, "Sit down at the kitchen table and look at the door." He said, "Here's the prayer. Write it down. God, I don't know what I'm doing. Help me, please." And then he said, "I want you to think of every place that you lived and every job that you had and every group that you ran with. And if, as people from these different phases of your life walk through the door, if your stomach goes like that, write their name down, and then you get three sentences on why. Nobody's life is that interesting." And I did that. And then he said, write the sexual weirdness. He said, who you hate and who you're afraid of. And he said, and then we'll talk tomorrow. It took me about 4 hours. Wasn't, I mean, it was fairly long. It was, no, fairly long is not, it was maybe 5 pages legal. And I write big because I shake a lot. And I got it done. Was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all 4 columns? No. No. It was the greatest hits. You know? It was the stuff that when my head goes down on the pillow, it always popped up. And I got it out of my head and onto the paper, and my sponsor came and we sat down. We read the stuff, and I said the stupid prayers, and then we burned it. And I'm 23 days sober, and I'm a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done some stuff. I'm not just sitting in a chair agreeing with it. Now, this is the program of recovery that in those days was what we were doing. Wasn't a lot of books. There wasn't a lot of book studying going on because the telephone was ringing at the Alano Club. You know, and I had a car. And they'd say, don't talk to him. Go pick him up and bring him back. We'll take care of it from there. You know, and I got out and I started making my amends. And I went to my grandmother Alice, who used to have the Oxbow Inn down on East Marginal there next to Boeing Field. And she taught me how to tend bar. I owed her just a little money. And I said, Grandmother, I've stolen this money from you, and I'm so, God and AA are keeping me sober. Please forgive me. Here's some of the money. And she said, what'd you say? I said, God and AA are keeping me sober. Here's some money. And she goes, thanks. And then she got her purse and her hat, and she starts moving for the door. Where are you going? She said, about 5 years ago, you and I had a conversation where you said you didn't believe in God anymore. So I went down and I put your name on a list down at the church, and me and the girls have been praying for you, and I get to go down and report that my grandson has been restored. Spiritual terrorism. It works really, really well. In 1985, my then wife Jacqueline got sober, and it was a wonderful occurrence in my life. And we picked 3 people: her best childhood friend, our friend Jeannie, who was working at a cocktail waitress at a saloon that we were working in, and then my sister Regina, who was missing in action with her self-employed Colombian boyfriend. And we prayed for him at every meeting we went to. In the moment of meditation afterwards. Within 1.5 years, all 3 of them got sober. All 3 of them picked up birthday cakes. And after that, one of them, the girl who got sober in the treatment center, decided that she'd made a mistake. She'd made too much of this. But Jeannie and my sister Regina have not had a drink since. Alcoholics Anonymous, it works. It really, really works. I'll give you a spiritual terrorism 101. Because you all know somebody who's really bad. Like, you may be in here just getting the heat off, being good for a little while, but you know somebody's got a real problem. You know, the one you're always looking down at, if I ever get that bad. And then 1 year later, he's worse, so you got a ways to go still. When you walk into a meeting place and you see an empty chair, just walk up and tap the chair and say their name. I believe that that person may be sent to the meeting. That may be somebody that I work with that saves my life. So, Michael and I, in those days, we were just running around, grabbing drunks, going to coffee. It was a whole different society. The downsizing hadn't happened. The treatment centers hadn't funneled a lot of people in. We were busy. Phone was ringing off the hook. That's the way we became members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Clara described it so well yesterday that it was in the seeing ourselves and the suffering of another that we really got a clue of who we were. And then this is an opinion. But then when this treatment center started sending lots of people in, what happened is that the activity got different. And we had lots of people who were coming into Alcoholics Anonymous with information that they'd gotten from well-meaning professional people. And one of the great things that happened is that Alcoholics Anonymous stayed Alcoholics Anonymous, because there were some really, really well-meaning, well-intentioned, brilliant people that wanted us to be all things to all people. And what happened is that those of us who were here, we went back to the literature. And we got in this process of working with people, reading out of the book. Now, most folks, in those days, that was not going on. It was not part of the culture in Los Angeles that I know of. And most of the people that were sober in those days, they were not reading the book one-on-one with people. And I didn't know about that. I didn't know. How did I start doing that? The way I started doing that was I had this sponsor by the name of Fred. Mike had left town, and I had this sponsor, Fred Ellis. And Fred was one of the great members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a tremendous man. In fact, what I did was that I just I thought about it for a while, and I just went and I asked the man that I admired most in Alcoholics Anonymous to be my sponsor. And he was a busy guy. And he said, you may not be able to get me whenever you want me. But he said, if you ever need me, you will always be able to get me. And anyway, so I'm going along working with Fred, and it's all about, guys like you don't sign up on any speaker lists, because he knew who I was. See, I didn't get to do this kind of thing until I didn't have anything to say. And anyway, one day I was in those days. This is the mid '80s, and my then wife had gotten sober, and so I'm back to going to 7 meetings a week, and I'm, secretary of the speaker meeting. The people that are the best sponsors in the world are the ones between 3 and 8 years sober, because they know everything, and they're willing to tell you for hours on end. Get a sponsor who still smokes. They really know the truth. Anyway, I had a job, a traveling sales job, and I'm busy. And during that time, there were a few guys that came to me and asked me to sponsor them, and there was this one guy that came up, and he was shuffling like this, and his glasses hadn't been cleaned in about 7 weeks. And he'd just gotten out of the Twin Towers, the county jail down in Los Angeles, and he was just really unsettled on his pins, and he asked me to be his sponsor, and I took one look at him, and I said, I'm really busy in AA, and why don't we get together tomorrow, and we'll go to the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag Monday night, and I'll introduce you to some guys who can save your life. I was not used to standing up for myself. I wasn't used to giving myself care. So I called to report to my sponsor about how much I'd evolved spiritually, the insights that I'd had about myself, my quest to find balance in my life. And he said, "You did what?" He said, "You go and you find that man and you ask him if you can please have the honor of sharing with him what has been so freely given to you. Did I say no to you? Click!" Fred had been a Marine. And he'd been a numbers runner for the mob in Los Angeles while suffering from blackouts. You didn't want him mad. So I went and I found Kevin. And Kevin had left school in 5th grade. And Kevin couldn't read. And so that's where I started reading aloud with guys, because every time Kevin came over and we read together, I got a lot out of what was going on. I got a lot of what was going on, you know. Before that, I'd had guys, you know, reading and then just, are you reading the big book? Oh, yeah, I'm reading the big book. Ready to do the third step? Oh, well, blah, blah, blah. You know. Are you working on your inventory? Yeah, I'm working on it. Now, I started formatting a little bit. And then what I did was, is because I wanted to grow in effectiveness, I started sponsoring people when I had like 29 days sober. Guy walked up to me and asked me to sponsor him. I went to my sponsor. I said, what should I do? He said, if they're sick enough to ask you, you have to say yes. Hopefully you're the lower rung on the ladder. Help him up. Okay. And but what had happened, see, I'm alcoholic. And I'm afraid that I'm not going to drink. And I'm obsessed with alcohol when I'm new. And every time my sponsor would say to me that he thought he might be someplace, I was there. I never missed an appointment with him. I never missed having Friday dinner with he and his wife, where we'd sit around and talk about sobriety, and they'd all laugh at me. She and her Al-Anon friends. And Bonnie Bergman, who died of cancer a long time ago. And so I took out great men, Jack Prose, Ken O'Brien, Fred Ellis, Vern Stamps. And I asked each of these men what their sponsors did with them, and I took a pad and a piece of paper, and I said, and then what do you do with the guys that they sponsor? And they were, you know, I mean, when you ask people you admire what they do, they love to talk about themselves. Especially if you're buying lunch. Buy people you admire lunch. If you're secretary of a speaker meeting, you want to make AA a wonderful place to be, ask the speakers if they'd like to come and join you for dinner before the meeting. You know, because they all need to get a bite to eat. But what happens is that's how I got close to Clara. You know, it was, you know, I mean, that's what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know all these wonderful people just because somebody said, hey, I didn't know how to answer the telephone until I was 35 years old. I'm sober 11 years, and I call Dr. Paul up, and I say, hey, I call Paul up, and he picks the phone up, and he says, hi, this is Paul. How may I help you? Any conversation that I get to have with a person, I try and remember always to say, is there something I can do for you? It's amazing what people will tell you. Just paying attention in AA. So I got this stuff and I started working. I mixed some stuff around and I came up with a format that kind of worked for me. You know, and it changes over time. You know, because this thing about passing the information on is a wonderful thing. But this one-on-one, working the steps with people is just a great, it's a great, great thing. Fred died of cancer in 1987. What am I going to do? I've had one of the great men. And so when he'd been diagnosed again, I came up with the sponsor. Here's the find the sponsor prayer. God, if there be a God, if you want that, you can put that part in. Help me to recognize the person when they come through the door. And I was sitting at a meeting, and there was this guy who got up, and he started spouting this hard-line, big book stuff. And I thought, Fred wasn't dead yet. And I thought, oh, I should talk to that guy. And then, of course, I forgot about it. But a few months after Fred passed, I kept saying that prayer, and this man was at the meeting, and I went, oh. And then I went and asked him to lunch, and I sat down to kind of interview him a little bit and found out that every area of my life, there was something that he had experience in. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. it's a wonderful thing to have an AA home. The most important job in the world. Aside, of course, from the GSR. The most important job in Alcoholics Anonymous is actually the sponsor's wife. She's a counterintelligence agent and a great source of information. When I was courting my wife, I said to her, I need your help. When I was courting Adele, I said, I need your help. Will you help my friends who have no skills at all? Will you help them to get into nice, wonderful, loving relationships? And she said, yes. And our home is a source of nurturing for men and women that are on the path, learning to share, wanting to share their lives with another human being. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Newcomers come first in our house. It doesn't matter when the phone rings. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. It's just God on the phone anyway. That's one of the things Fred told me. Well, I'm sponsoring a lot of people. He said, no, you're not. He said, never, ever count the number of people you sponsor. Don't know. He said, you're just sponsoring the next person that's on the telephone. So I got no responsibility. I just answer the phone. So this household that we have is just, it's a wonderful thing. You know, there's this these disparaging remarks about, oh, I'm not going to date a woman in the program, or AA men are all a bunch of pigs. Okay. but, you know, see, if Alcoholics Anonymous is the first thing in my life, how the, if I'm out shopping for a mate, why am I not going to get somebody that is on this path? They don't have to be in AA, but Al-Anon or OA. I had a guy, an old timer, one time tell me, look me dead in the eye and say, women who are in recovery in the program of Overeaters Anonymous are the greatest lovers in the world because they have to work the program harder than anyone because they walk the tiger every day. And I got one. I got mine. But what is it, the line, the Dating in Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds are good, but the goods are odd? But can you imagine a guy like me trying to represent that I don't have any problems to anyone? I mean, if a woman finds me attractive, there are large psychic gaps, okay? And I'd much rather have her at least acknowledge that she has them. The holiest place in the world is the birthing room, to be there when a child is born. The second holiest place in the world is the coffee table, where a woman or a man says, I think this might work for me. This is the greatest privilege that anyone can have. You can actually be there at the moment that somebody's soul is reignited or their spirit is reborn or however you want to say it. You know, I mean, but something happens and you have the privilege to be there. And once you've tasted it, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And as you go along, you get to go through all the different processes of, you know, people say, oh, I don't sponsor there. I'm just not good at it. They all drink. Read the book. You know, Bill worked for a long, long time before he started to get people even starting to be interested. And that was Cleveland. You know, and of all the people that that ask me to work with them, I mean, how many actually keep showing up? You know, you have to be pretty badly mangled to end up in my living room. It's always fascinating who's on my couch, you know. And so we go through this process. A fun thing happened a number of years ago. I was about, I was 14 and a half years sober. I was in a big change in my life. My first marriage had ended. I was with my fabulous wife, Adele. A guy was busy smoking crack and was trying to get a guy that I sponsored was on the 12-step call away from him. He was in the bathroom, and so he threw this pamphlet that had been written in Texas, and then Dr. Paul had put in a format about an unofficial guide to the 12 steps about working in a group. And so I called all the guys up, and I said, I'm coming up on 15 years sober, and I'd like you to come and join me in working the steps. So the gang showed up, and I think Bill lasted two meetings, went off and formed his own group. Because I wasn't doing it correctly. And he didn't even have the interferon card to play in those days. But anyway, we sat down in this group. We started out with about 18 of us, and it whittled down to about 14. And of the 14, 12 of us actually did all the stuff. And what happened is I saw for the first time at a group level, within a year and a half, all these men's lives changed radically. All of us had more fabulous relationships. Our business careers all changed. I mean, it was just remarkable. And once again, I was able to see the power in a way that I hadn't experienced it before. And it was an incredible thing. Bill talked a little bit about our friend Patrick Keelahan. Keelahan. Try spelling that. And his mother really did call him the devil of all liars. I have heard him referred to as the sleaziest man in Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was in the freight forwarding business. And so he was always busy on Friday. And if I sponsor you, there are two things. I want you to go to at least one of the meetings that I go to, hopefully the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. And then second, we go on retreat every year. You know, you circle these dates. This is the requirement. Everybody knows. So Pat would go, yeah, I'm going to be on the retreat. I'm going to be on the retreat. I'll be there late. And he'd go on retreat all right. He'd stop on Century Boulevard, get a couple professionals, a couple eight balls, and go to the Viscount Hotel and spend the weekend there. Guy never had a sobriety date much, and then finally, he got sober. You know, he always represented himself as being sober. In fact, one time I was, after he'd gotten sober, this time he was, I was driving along and I was out of town on business, and I wasn't going to be able to give him a birthday cake, and he's ragging on me about, oh, you're not going to be there to give me my two-year cake. How can you do? What kind of sponsor? Blah, 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 blah. And I thought about it, and I'd already given him a two-year cake. He just wasn't sober at the time. I said, screw you, Trick. I did my job just because you weren't really there. But I didn't fire Patrick. They don't hire me, and I can't send anybody away. Who God sends to me, they're taking advantage of me. Oh, really? How tragic. They're eating up my valuable time. Well, get some boundaries. You know? But, you know, we don't send them away. So here's this guy. I mean, bad example, number 305A, okay? And he calls one day, and he says, I got lung cancer. I'm going to die, and I'm afraid. And from the doctor's office, he came to our house, and we sat there and we prayed, and it was time. Am I full of shit? Or aren't I? Will I show up? What kind of man am I really? And what I found out is that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member in good standing of AA, and I go where I'm asked, and I do the next good thing. There's no question. There's no question. If you're sitting around wondering, what's the next good thing to do, and then go do it. And so we walked this man, who was 39 years old, to the door. And it was not easy, and it was not fun. But along the line, you know, we had a good time. We really did. And Patrick gave us a lot of gifts, and it was so funny. Adele and I were going to go on our honeymoon. We were going to leave, go to Hawaii. And he called me up, and he said, "You can't go. I'm dying." And I looked at Adele, and I said, "We can't go. He's dying. And if we would have gone, he would have passed." So we just never made it to Hawaii until this year. It was 7-8 years ago. Because I'm called to love. See, when people ask us to sponsor them, what they're asking us to do is to love them. Maybe for the first time in their life. And what we get to do is we get to learn to love, and the longer we love and the better we get at loving, what happens is that there's fewer and fewer demands that we make about loving. And we grow in effectiveness. And we enter into this fourth dimension of existence that is beyond description. It is thrilling to live in the fourth dimension, and it does exist. It's not something that's just written in this silly book. If you don't just agree with AA, but if you buy the whole package and you come on this ride, buckle up, baby. It'll never look anything like you think it will. But where you end up is insanely wonderful. You know? It's just amazing. And just doing the next good thing. I had the privilege of reciting St. Patrick's breastplate with the immigrant mother anointing her son moments before he passed. I get called, I used to live in a Pinto, and you see me today walking down the street, and I'm picking up cigarette butts, and I won't look you in the eye. That's who I am. And people now call me when their babies are being born. And they call me when their babies are dying. And that seemingly good and that seemingly bad, I can't do anything about that. But I can make the experience sober. I can help people not to drink through it. You keep sponsoring people, and I pray what happened to me happens to you, that everything you know about God gets stripped from you. And you stand there after going to the hospital day in and day out and watching people suffering. And, you know, you think about what you'd heard about Jesus. He did what he wanted to. He was 36 years old. They had a bad weekend, you know. And you see these people suffering for months. And I went through this period of about 6 weeks where I had no connection with God. I always had something going on. And then one night, I walk out of the Miller's Children's Hospital and I smelled the night blooming jasmine. And I came back. Because I was willing. I was wanting. I was waiting. And it came. So I won't presume to tell you any more about God. So I can tell you how God smells. And sometimes she smells really sweet. You know, I had an experience when I was newly sober where I saw the light. And I know that everything's perfect. I forget frequently, you know. I want to get a tattoo and put it on my wife's forehead. Perfect. Because I forget sometimes. Dream deep. Dream deep. Start living If you're sober and you're involved in this work, drop all your fears and just get out there on the edge. And you'll have experiences that are beyond your wildest dreams. You know, I was sitting around before the beginning of this year going, if I could do anything, what would I do? And Frank Buchman, the guy who started the Oxford Group, said, if you get a chance to ever talk to a person, tell them your deepest truth. And this is my deepest truth, that I had a wonderful, wonderful life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had all the love. I had everything that a man could ever want. But when I started adding meditation to my life, my relationship with this world changed. And it became a whole lot better, especially for those around me. So I want to suggest to you that the 11th step is not a Chinese menu. From my experience, you can tell that I'm really good praying, right? I can talk all day long to God. I'm good at it. But until I started sitting in the silence, my life changed. So I'm sitting around and I go, if I could do anything, what would I do? And Frank Buchman, the guy who started the Oxford Group, at one point they changed it to moral rearmament to try and get nations to change instead of people, to try and stop the Second World War. And on the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of December in 1939, they tried to get 100 million people to sit in the quiet to listen if there might be a solution other than violence. It's the most outlandish thing I've ever heard. And this has got nothing to do with your political persuasion or where you are. But I am talking about that there is an answer beyond our human consciousness. And so I thought if I could do anything in the world, I'd invite people to get quiet. So I went to a buddy of mine and I started this thing called 3 minutes of silence. I got a card up here if you want it. And it's the number 3, then minutesofsilence.org. Encouraging people to spend 3 minutes a day in silence. And on it, there's a wheel with a dozen different ways to get quiet, different religions, stuff that's non-religious, just spiritual. Just to encourage people to try it. You know, do spirituality the way you drank, man. Dive in. Try it all. But if they look at you, there's a caveat. If they look at you and they tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of consciousness, smile at them. And move away. Because they don't have to know. But we know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do is that we care for the sick. And we visit them in the jails. And we raise the dead. And they don't know that. And they won't understand it. And they don't need to. So the second day of October was the first time that we got people from all over the planet within this particular format to get quiet together. And I had a tremendous, tremendous experience, and some of my friends did too, and it was a wonderful thing. But what it was my dream. I did my dream, and I'm doing my dream. And part of my dream that day, there's many of you here that I know that I was able to, you know, bring through my heart that day. As I was ramping up to that 3 minutes, you know, and my life is not my own. Thursday, I'm talking to a kid from Vietnam. I said, I need a friend in Vietnam. And he told me some stuff that he's doing. And so we're going to go build some schools in the Mekong Delta. Why not? What better thing do I have to do? My father never came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was a bad drunk. And when his drinking partner, my stepmother, Marcia, died of cirrhosis, the way that they were able to express, this is my DNA, this is my family of origin, this is the way they made love at the end. They drank salty dogs and ate Vicodin together. Alcoholism, the family disease. anyway, after she died, I waited a few weeks, and I went up, and I drove up, and I caught the old man. He was sitting in his command post. He lived 10 miles away, or 10 hours away. I just happened to drop by. And he was in his command post, covered in his own waste. And I was able to clean him up, put him in the shower, not talk down to him. You know why? Because I've been on the 12-step calls. I know how to do that. And I got him cleaned up, and I said, okay, Dad, I'm going to take you to detox tomorrow. I'm not talking about you going to the silly meetings, but we're going to go detox tomorrow. And next morning, he said, nope, been thinking all night, not going to go. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just hit him with something heavy, and we'll throw him in the trunk. No big deal. And so anyway, I take him, and I want to take him, and he won't go. So I went and had a quad espresso, and I meditated for a little while, and I remembered Dr. Bob's line about, you know, if you want to quit drinking on your own, that's entirely your affair. And I let you know, and so I left without any acrimony at all. I just said, okay. And he kicked by himself. And anyway, after a while, it was Easter the next year, and my sister called me, and she said, Dad's really sick. You better get up there. And so I went up, and I saw him, and I let him be a cowboy for a day. And then he was living down in Wairika. I had a ranch down there. And so I take him to the hospital, and he's got cancer growing fast. And so I got to sit there with him and say, I don't like the hand. And he said, well, what do we do? And I said, well, let's go home. I got the skills. I got the time. I knew how to do it. Gordon and Priscilla Cleveland had let me in their home when they were dying. I'd walked my friend Patrick to the door. I knew how to be a man. I knew how to be a son. And we went home, you know. And a couple weeks later, he died. When he died, his mother was there, and my sister was there, my sister's been sober. My sister Regina's been sober for coming up on 20 years. And she, she had a conversation one day with him, and she was talking about her sponsor. And he said, well, what's a sponsor? And she described what she thought a sponsor was. And I'd been talking to my dad about staying away from the front drink and all that stuff, and why I don't drink, you know, Virgin Marys. And my dad said, well, I guess Jay would be my sponsor. Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It's not in the first 164 pages of the book, by the way. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to do to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Number two, it is a pleasure. Number three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me. But at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink and knew I could not, but I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it because nobody ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat. If you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you think you're strong enough to beat the game on your own, that's entirely your affair. But if you wish to quit drinking liquor for good and for all, we know we have an answer for you. It works It never fails if you go about it with one half the zeal that you're in the habit showing when you were getting your next drink. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Thank you.